Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
And we are recording. And I'm delighted to have back with me Amber O'Hearn, who has a very eclectic background. She has academic publications in several fields, including theoretical mathematics, cognitive psychology, computational linguistics, and more recently, evolutionary nutrition and biology. She's been studying and experimenting with low-carb keto diets since 1997, and is particularly interested in evolutionary constraints and interspecies differences. And she's been eating a nearly plant-free diet since 2009, seeing a complete recession of her bipolar symptoms without relapse. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
It's really great to have you back on again. I first saw your writing on Ketotic, I think. Your blog about your old blog about the keto diet you were following and the carnivore or plant free diet you were following. So I'd been looking at keto for a while and paleo, and then came across this sort of new subdivision, sort of keto double plus, where people weren't eating any plants. You know, so it was blogs like Zero Carb Zen and yours and others. And you know, you've been doing it for about 12 years now, and your time with it is sort of bearing fruit in the form of a book you're putting together called Facultative Carnivore. Can you talk us through the title first and then maybe an overview of what you're doing with the book?
Sure, yes, thanks for asking about that. You know, Facultative Carnivore was the original title I came up with, and it's still the website name, but I've relegated it to subtitle in part because it's a little bit tricky to understand. So the title that I'm going with right now is Eat Meat, Not Too Little, Mostly Fat, which you might recognize as a play on Michael Pollan's Eat Food, Not Too Much, Mostly Plants. But the facultative part is also supposed to be a bit of a play on words, because in biology, facultative, it has a specific meaning. A facultative carnivore is an animal that is carnivorous but can get by eating plants, even mostly plants, in many situations, but it doesn't overcome the fact that they are carnivorous by nature. It's just a kind of flexibility. It comes from the word optional. I mean, facultative means optional. And so the play there is that I'm a carnivore by choice. And so that's where I was going with that name.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so how's the book shaping up, and what's the kind of overview of it?
Well, the book has many more chapters to come. I started it quite some time ago, and it's been slow going, partly because I decided to self-publish, and that means that I don't have deadlines in the way that I would have if somebody else were publishing it, which is both good and bad, because, well, it's good because it allows me to really be rigorous and follow the way that I think the book should go. And it's bad because I've allowed other things to sometimes take precedence. which is also sometimes good. For example, in 2019, I put everything on the book on hold because I had something like 11 talks in the space of 12 months, most of which were new talks. So I had to do this real marathon, it felt like, of creating the material for the new talks every month and giving that new talk. And I traveled to many places. I was lucky that that happened the year that it did and not the year after. And I learned a lot, but it was very intensive from a creative writing point of view. But the book itself has, I wanted to introduce, first of all, why someone would go on such a crazy sounding diet when there are many other diet choices they could make that many people get good results from and don't impose such heavy restrictions, which are mostly, I think, social restrictions. That's really the hardest part about it. And then I wanted to go through why eating a carnivore diet is actually a nutritious option as opposed to what one might think initially when they hear about removing plants, which are often held to be the most nutritious component of the diet, which is really a big mistake. And then in upcoming chapters, and I've started to get into this a little bit in the previous one, I want to talk about what makes humans so different and special, because we're actually very different from, we're different from our closest primate relatives in our diets. We're much more carnivorous in many ways, but we're also different from other carnivores because of that provenance from the primate heritage that we have. So we don't really have the same kind of nutritional needs or ability to eat in the same way that, say, a lion or a wolf would eat. So I wanted to go into that. And then I plan to talk about history, both from sociological diets in different societies over time, and also the progression of how we got to the carnivore diet through other ways of eating, like you mentioned, paleo and ketogenic diets themselves. And then at the end, I'll get into a bit of ethical things.
Brilliant. It sounds like a very wide-ranging investigation. And that's something that I think is quite rare, full stop, but especially online, and maybe even especially amongst people who are interested in different diets online. You know, you quite often find yourself making statements that contradict what the vast majority of people in, say, the low-carb community would say dogmatically, or because they heard it from someone who's also clever. And that's something that I really value about anything that you're writing, is that you really try to follow the evidence to come to your own conclusions, regardless of what other people are saying. But I think the other really interesting component is that, you know, you've been through an awful lot in terms of your own health, which is so often the case. And I think someone who's as astute as you, who's been through that and then bearing witness, is extremely important to be a reliable witness, because I think often anecdotes are dismissed, but yours is a particularly powerful one. And we spoke about your bipolar in the last podcast, but I think it's such an important aspect of your experience that we should revisit it. Can you tell us how bad it got and the effect going plant-free had on you? And, sure. And maybe afterwards, why you think it might have worked?
Yeah, I think the whole anecdote problem is something that we should take seriously, because it's really easy to fool yourself. And when you're just one person, there are so many factors that are going into what's going on in your life that it can be really hard to be a good judge of whether something is really having the effect that you think it is. And I don't, you know, like Feynman said, Richard Feynman, the physicist, not the biochemist, said, you are the easiest person to fool, right? So I've been very self-conscious about that from the beginning. And in fact, you know, I've been on this diet since 2009, and I didn't even really start writing about it very much until 2012, when that blog you mentioned came out. I had been writing a little bit about it on forums, but to really come out and say this is what happened to me was a big, it took a lot of courage for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that having a, you know, psychiatric disorder is a huge stigma, and I didn't want it to get in the way of, for example, hiring later or something like that. But I also didn't want to make big mistakes. I'm less afraid of mistakes now because I think I'm able to say things with confidence without saying that I could be wrong. And so I try to emphasize that as well. But as to the bipolar, I mean, what happened to me, there's no doubt that it's very different from some way that I could be fooling myself in that. I was first diagnosed with depression when I was 20, and I started taking antidepressants. They weren't very effective for me, even though I continued to take them because there wasn't really any alternative. And I was the diagnosis was modified to treatment-resistant major depressive disorder because of the fact that it wasn't going away and it wasn't very well addressed. But that went on for quite some time until in my early 30s, I started having hypomanias, which is like manic episodes in manic depression or bipolar, except that it doesn't go to the point of psychosis. And so when that started happening, that's when I got re-diagnosed to bipolar type 2, and the type 2 just designates that I don't have the full-blown mania. I actually, in retrospect, think that this transition to bipolar may have been exacerbated by the use of antidepressants, because antidepressants can have that effect. But whatever the cause of it was, it just was progressing to worse and worse. And even when I changed to medications that should have been more appropriate given my updated diagnosis, the disease continued to progress. And what I mean by that is the hypomanias became more frequent, but I also started experiencing what they call mixed states. So in traditional bipolar, your two states are very distinct. When you're depressed, everything is depressed. Your physiology is depressed. Your thoughts are slowed down. You're tired. You maybe sleep and eat more. And when you are manic, everything is sped up. So you're having euphoria. You're having a lot of rapid brain activity, hypersexuality. When you get mixed states, it's like the physiology and the cognition can get differential such that you could have lots of energy, but your mood is really bad. So that would come out in like irritability or even rage. So there were mixed states that were appearing, and also the cycles were getting faster and faster. So by the time it was the end of 2008, before I found the carnivore diet, I would say that I was having mood switching within a single day, not weeks or months at a time like traditional bipolar could have. And it was absolutely miserable. And the drugs that I was trying, I tried many different bipolar medications, and not only were they not helping me, but they all came with terrible side effects. And my life just felt like it was spinning out of control. So, you know, to go from that to having no symptoms of bipolar disorder no depression, no suicidality, is not something that you can just talk yourself into or make a mistake about. And to see that stay the case for over 10 years is what really makes me sure that I have, you know, that I haven't made some kind of mistake. And bipolar isn't just something that normally goes into remission for 10 years. Yeah, you might have some normal periods of months at a time even, but years, no.
And do you ever get a negative reaction when talking about resolving your symptoms with food?
Well, it's not something that comes up in casual conversation very often, but, you know, maybe it does more often than you might think, because what I eat is very visible. So it's when, as soon as I start meeting people or hanging out with them socially, it becomes very evident that the way I'm eating is different, and I'm quite frank about why if they ask. And the response that I've had has been, I would say, overwhelmingly positive, because everyone is, you know, congratulatory about having overcome something. And there's also often a lot of interest, because psychiatric issues, they're not as visible as, say, weight problems. Everyone can see that the country and the Western world has a problem with weight, but not everyone can see that the Western world has a problem with mood disorders. But it's very, very common. And so most people respond actually with interest, because either they personally or someone that is close to them is having a similar kind of problem.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, the statistics kind of grimly speak for themselves on mood disorders these days. You know, there's some talk about more diagnoses happening and certain incentives for that being the case. Certainly more pharmaceuticals are distributed if that's the case. But I do think that on the whole, it's because there is more of a problem. And I think increasingly people are looking for alternative solutions, because you can see that it's not just in real terms, not just in raw numbers, that the pharmaceuticals are being prescribed at a much higher level. It's that proportionally they are too, and they're not working very well on an average population basis. In an individual level, they can be life-saving. But, mm-hmm. I attended a lecture. It was an esteemed academic. I think she was at Cambridge University. And, you know, she works on life-extending drugs. So some of these in combination have been extremely impressive in mice. You know, they can extend lives by double-digit percentages. And, you know, she was showing the graph that showed the straight line improvement, more or less, in life expectancy since the Industrial Revolution started, and stated offhand that old chestnut that in Paleolithic times adults would typically die in the 30s. And, you know, I couldn't believe the mental misstep. I thought maybe it was, you know, the cynical side of me thought maybe it was calculated to kind of bolster the case for requiring life-extending drugs. But more likely, I think it's this cognitive bias that you speak about in your book, that humans have such profound design flaws that we need propping up more or less as soon as we enter adulthood. Or, you know, another way to put it is that our hubris is so great. We think it's simply the wonders of modern medicine that have added 50 years to our lives. And I think that, you know, the same paradigm exists in mental health. But, you know, what would you say about that attitude?
Well, there are statistical problems, I think, with that, with trotting out the 30-year idea. One of them is that's an average, and it includes life expectancy that would include infant mortality, which would have been or was a huge contributor to that statistic. There's also the fact that they they didn't have the kinds of medical interventions that can prevent, for example, infectious or wound dealing with kinds of medicine. But there's another idea that is a little subtle, and I don't have it in front of me, but I'll see if I can explain it. It's that when paleoanthropologists are looking at, or archaeologists are looking at bones of someone that they have found and are trying to estimate what their age is, part of that estimation comes from how healthy they were. So they could look at that person and say, oh, these remains look like the remains of a 30-year-old, but that's taking into account the bias of what a 30-year-old looks like today. And so there's a little bit of circular reasoning going on. Like, it could be that a 40-year-old skeleton from then had the same health properties that a 30-year-old skeleton today would. So that's another issue that can come up with looking at those statistics. Some people talk about the natural selection, the fact that natural selection only applies to people who are of reproductive age, and they make an argument that it could be that things that are making us very healthy enough to reproduce very well are actually detrimental in old age. And I think that that's a good line of thinking if you're trying to, if you have an observation that old people are less healthy, and you're trying to explain how that could be from a genetic point of view. But if you don't have that data, then it becomes an argument for something that isn't an actual observation. So that the default argument should be that anything that makes you healthy in your 20s should contribute to better health into your older age too. And it also, the whole idea that the only important thing for natural selection is reproduction defies the fact that social organisms like humans have a great deal of survival advantages that come from older people in the community, grandparents or even just elders, that make the survivability of younger generations increased without having a direct effect on reproduction.
Yeah, that's a common argument around eating a lot of meat around mTOR when it gets activated, and people saying, you know, it might be good for a hunter-gatherer to burn bright and die once their genes have passed on, but they were muscular and athletic while they were alive. But of course, you know, you point out that there's clear community advantages in grandparents being around in terms of passing on wisdom, in terms of caring for children, and being productive in other ways. And it's not like it's a rarity in modern hunter-gatherer communities. If you live past a certain age, then you're quite likely to live into older age. You even see it in other mammalian species, don't you? Where whales, some whales, for example, have postmenopausal caring females. So I don't think it holds much weight, but it is an interesting idea. Gives you pause for thought.
If you want to, we could talk a little bit more about mTOR, because I think that there are some misunderstandings about that as well, as it applies to plant-based diets versus more carnivorous diets.
Please, yeah, if you could maybe just explain what it is, and then feel free to go ahead with that.
Sure. mTOR is something that is associated with aging, in that it's a growth factor. It's a kind of integrator of growth factors, and it's a signal that tells the body to grow. And so the idea has been, and this is supported by all kinds of different scientific observations, that if you have high levels of mTOR, then growth is going to be faster and you're more susceptible to things like cancer, which is a growth disorder. And if you reduce mTOR, if you inhibit it, then that's associated with all kinds of longevity. The things that affect mTOR that increase it, on the one hand, is high insulin, but on the other hand, there's a big contribution from protein as well. So I think you would say that the people who are enthusiasts about ketogenic diets are emphasizing the insulin part of that equation and saying, look, we're lowering insulin, and thereby we're lowering mTOR, and therefore this is a longevity positive kind of dietary intervention. Whereas the plant-based people are going to say, hey, protein has a huge effect on mTOR, and so if you're, and especially some of the proteins that are in meat, the amino acids specifically, so if you go on a plant-based diet, then you're drastically reducing that push on mTOR, and so that should be a longevity-enhancing diet. And they're both right in a sense, but what I would say is a good way to synthesize those ideas, even if you're on a carnivore diet where you're getting a lot of mTOR stimulation from eating meat, you're getting it in the context of a diet that is highly ketogenic. So your insulin levels are going to be a lot low, and what you're going to be getting is this pulsatile triggering of mTOR. And we should emphasize, you don't want to be in a low mTOR state all the time, because that will make you actually very weak. You want to have strong bones and you want to have strong muscles. So you never want to be in a situation where you're not triggering mTOR ever. I think that the best of both worlds. See, a ketogenic diet, and even say if you look at the work of Walter Longo, who has done a lot of research on the benefits of fasting, specifically because of the way it reduces mTOR, he would say that his compromise is eat a plant-based diet, because that's the basic way to be getting longevity, but you also have to do these, for example, 5 days a month would be a typical kind of intervention from Longo type studies, where you want to get into deep ketosis, because ketosis is a particularly longevity enhancing state. But the thing is, the reason it takes 5 days of fasting from a plant-based basis is because you have to get into ketosis, and that takes maybe 3 days to do. So it stands to reason that if you're already on a ketogenic diet, the amount of time that you have to get into this very low mTOR state to get full benefit would be 1 or 2 days instead of 3 to 5 days. What I'm arguing is that if you're on a carnivore diet, which is already ketogenic, even just your overnight fasting is going to be triggering more of those pathways associated with lower mTOR every day than you would ever be getting on a plant-based diet.
That makes sense. There's a couple of ways I want to go here. And I'll come back to the second one, but the first one that came to mind was the chat that goes on amongst people who tend to be meat-eating keto people of one type or another about the protein to energy ratio, and how many people do really well focusing on prioritizing lean sources of protein. So they'll put at the very center of what they're eating lean cuts of meat or fish, and they won't add fat of any kind, really, you know, and they'll have that as their sort of golden rule. And other people do poorly on this, and they do much better in terms of mood, weight, hormonal balance, etc., when they really prioritize eating fat, and probably particular types of fat. So what's going on there? Why does the extremely high fat approach work for, well, firstly, for weight regulation when, you know, people are eating a lot of fat? And why do different people succeed with such different tactics, do you think?
It's a very contentious issue and has been actually the whole time that I've been involved in the low carb community. There have been these swings of high protein to high fat, and I want to try to steelman the high protein approach because I've been known for arguing against it and promoting the high fat way. But first, let me emphasize that yes, lots of people do see success by focusing on lean meat, and the reason that is often given, I guess there would be two reasons. One is this idea of protein leverage. There's a hypothesis, the protein leverage hypothesis from Simpson and Robbenheimer, and what they base that on, what they observed, is that widely across species, in many contexts, if the diet composition, the food that you have access to, has too low an availability of protein, because part of our hunger instinct and the way that what our bodies are trying to do by eating is given by the need for protein, then with food that's fairly dilute in protein, you simply have to eat a lot more of it to get to your protein needs. And they give this as an explanation for the current obesity. They say we have all these low protein foods and people are overeating in order to compensate and get enough protein. And so all these extra calories are coming in by the side, and our appetite isn't telling us not to eat them because our appetite is right now saying we don't have enough protein, so it doesn't matter if we're getting too many calories. And I think that explanation does have a lot of power when the food is truly low in protein and when we're not getting enough. The problem with that way of thinking is that it doesn't really explain why a higher protein diet might be better for weight loss when you're comparing adequate protein, which might be somewhere along the lines of anywhere from 15 to 25%, it would be depending on how many calories you're eating, because protein is an absolute, not a percent need. Going from that to leaner meat isn't really about protein leverage, because we need to have calories, and if you're already getting an adequate amount of protein, you wouldn't be overeating to do that. It might be an explanation if your original diet was very low in protein. The second way that this has been explained as a mechanism for losing weight is the very simple and intuitive idea that if you're eating, given the fact that you're eating enough protein, any fat that you add on top of that into your diet is competing with the fat on your body that you could be using for energy. And while there is some truth to that, there's also some nuance to be had, because it's making the assumption that you can get all the fat that you need from your fat stores. And whether or not you can depends on different factors. One of the factors is how fat you are, because there are limits to how much fat you can release that are just in part strictly related to how much of it you have on your body. So for each gram of fat that you have in adipose tissue, so much of it can come out at a time. So you can well imagine that two people with identical metabolic states, that is, nothing else is interfering, the more fat mass you have, the more will flood into your system when you're in a state that's favoring lipolysis. So you could imagine that someone who's very fat should be able to get by with just protein, and their fat would give everything that they need. The problem is that sometimes very fat people don't have access to those fat stores because of the hormonal state. So you can't necessarily compare someone who is metabolically healthy with very low insulin, who's eating just protein, to somebody who's got very high insulin for whatever reason, and much of the time there are immunological reasons for having high insulin. So you could conceivably have someone who is very lean and isn't getting enough fat to cover their caloric needs and feels their body, their whole system feels bad, like they're tired, they're cold, they're just not running at full efficiency because there's not enough fat on their body to support that level of fasting. And the fact is that there can be people who are a lot fatter who are in the exact same situation, even though it looks like they should be able to get all the energy that they need from their stores, but they simply aren't. And so in that situation, giving your body more fat isn't competing with fat that could come off your body because it can't come off your body. And all that it's going to do is give you more energy, make you feel better, provide the hormonal substrate that you need. You mentioned mood. Like, if you don't have enough fat circulating in your blood, you're going to have your mood's going to tank, your sex hormones are going to tank. So if you provide that from the diet, not only is it not competing with your own fat stores, but it's actually providing the energy that then your body might need to use to repair the problems that are causing the high insulin in the first place and get you into a metabolic state that's more favorable for fat metabolism, which could in turn actually make your fat stores more willing to release. So my speculative explanation for the observation that I've made that some people do way better on high fat is that there's something preventing their fat from releasing, and that giving that extra energy is actually providing healing and allowing them to lose fat more quickly than they would if they simply did a protein-sparing modified fast. There's one more aspect to the protein, high protein versus high fat debate that I forgot about when I said that there were two, and there are probably way more. But there's the idea that protein is more satiating than fat, and this would be important if true or when it's true, because if a diet is satiating, almost by definition what it means is that it's allowing you to use more fat from your fat stores. Because for something to be satiating, if you're satiated, that means your bloodstream is full of energy and your brain centers and all of your peripheral tissues are getting the message that they have enough. So if you're ever not satiated, that means somewhere along the line there's this signal happening that's saying we need more energy. So if it were true that protein were causing more satiation, more satiety, then that would be indicating that somehow something about that is generating a better flow of your own fat within your own body. The problem is that the research that shows that protein is more satiating is limited to studies that are talking about mixed meals with carbohydrate, and we have almost no data on whether or not fat is more satiating or protein in the context of actually a low-carb diet. And what little studies that we have that would apply to that context actually show that fat is more satiating than protein is. I think there's a lot more work to be done because those studies that I've mentioned, they're talking about the effects on hormones like CCK and ghrelin, showing a better effect of fat, but they aren't the kinds of studies where we could feel really definitive about it in that they were not long-term low-carb studies. They might be like overnight fasted studies. So I think that's something that will really provide a lot of clarity about what's really going on with those two macronutrients. But what I would definitely say is that I have observed reports of lots of people who do really well on the high-protein, low-fat regime. But I've also observed lots of people who found that adding high protein at going to higher protein and lowering their fat not only didn't help them lose weight, and sometimes made them gain weight or made their hunger get out of control, had bad effects on their hormone levels and their mood. But when they went to very high fat, lowering protein, and there's a subtlety to be had there about just adding fat on top of high protein, because that might not actually do it. When they've gone to a lower but still adequate level of protein and much higher fat, suddenly they started dropping the weight. So what I would want people to know is that if you're having trouble with one way or the other, it's worth looking into the opposite way.
Yeah, when I was watching that whole, as I've been watching that whole debate, what you're saying rang true with me. And certainly around the idea of adding fat, there's a huge issue that comes up in keto forums and the like, where keto is often sold in this way. Yes, you have to give up bread, pasta, potatoes, but you can keep cheese and cream. And the issue there, obviously, is that there's fat and there's fat. Or I should say, there's fat and then there's fat with other things. You know, there's we're genetically programmed to be addicted to mother's milk. It wouldn't make sense for babies to be otherwise. And so mammalian milk is addictive to some people, and the proteins are. And so cheese and cream, although they in some ways are highly rewarding and hedonistic, it's not in the same way that, say, lamb fat is. And you find very quickly, if you try to eat lamb fat, that you'll feel a certain satiety that just doesn't come in the same way with, say, double cream.
Mm-hmm.
And that distinction's not made very much, I don't think. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that the people who massively up the fat levels, keeping the protein low and find weight loss comes back again, that it's unlikely to be dairy that does that.
Yeah. A lot of people have difficulty with dairy in particular, and with nuts for probably very different reasons. They seem to, I've experienced this myself, and you know, I was on a low carb diet that was not a carnivore diet for a good 12 years before I went on a carnivore diet. So I've experienced myself that cheese and nuts in particular have some kind of appetite dysregulating effect on me, where I will eat more of them than other fatty foods. And not only that, but sometimes I have found that dairy itself will cause just more eating of all foods widely. And I'm not sure why that is. There are a lot of different theories about why dairy should have that particular effect. Addiction is one of them. There are opiates in dairy, but there's also the fact that it's more highly insulinogenic, and like you point out, it's made for this period of time where an animal is supposed to get big fast. So there may be a variety of reasons. On the other hand, there are some people that just don't seem to have any trouble with dairy at all, and all the power to them, really.
Yeah, I've got to doff my cap to them. That's not me, though. coming right back again about Michael Pollan's aphorism about, you know, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And you've turned that on its head for eat meat, not too little, mostly fat. Can we talk about the continued faith that eating lots of plants is inherently good? Where does that come from, do you think? And why does that meme refuse to die?
Well, there are several ways to answer that question. One of them, if I could channel my friend Nick Mailer, who is a philosopher, he has talked a lot about the fact that meat has always, from the dawn of civilization, had the connotation of being sinful, carnal. it's indulgent, it's visceral, it doesn't have the halo that eating plants would have had from a religious and cultural perspective going all the way back to the beginning. And I think that aspect is still going on today. If you look at even just, I think this might apply to women more to men, but the image of a woman eating a salad gives this kind of chaste, pure, health glowing innocence to it that a woman gnawing on a steak doesn't have. There's something very very forbidden about meat in that cultural sense. And that has continued, I think, in part in a covert way by influencing religious movements that then became the beginnings of the very strong push for vegetarianism and veganism in the last century, by Kellogg and by Seventh-day Adventists in the United States, at least, who very much had a religious attitude toward meat eating that then went into, it sort of pushed the health aspects of it that were not really coming from a desire to get better health. So it was very biased in that way. And then we've had this long history for I guess maybe a century of progressive social acceptance of vegetarian ideas. So I mentioned to you before that I grew up vegetarian, and that was in part out of, well, I would say mainly for my parents in particular, out of ethical considerations, animal rights, animal kindness, more kinds of considerations, which I can definitely empathize with. But they were able to do that in part because there was already this huge movement of vegetarianism going on in their broader social context. So we had plenty of books about vegetarianism. And so that continues to carry on, and that momentum has built up over time in a way that meat eating has not. So I think it will be really important going forward to reestablish the basis of why we need meat in our diet in the first place, and our history as a species, the nutrients that our brains need, to dispel this kind of the word brainwashing came to mind. That might be a little bit excessive, but there really is this whole cultural phenomenon where people don't even question anymore the idea that a plant-based diet might not be the ultimate goal for human health.
And it seems like even smart people like Michael Pollan can do a fairly deep dive into published literature and come up with exactly the same answer, such as published literature now, I guess. I mean, what do we know about fat and the evolution of our brains?
Well, fat is important for humans. Humans have been around a lot longer than grain agriculture has. And even before we were humans, if you look at our evolution, we split from the line that led to modern chimpanzees and gorillas 4 million years ago or more. And so we've had this different trajectory that very early on went into a kind of hunting that chimpanzees never went into. Chimpanzees do hunt and they have small game in their diet, but they don't scavenge, and they never take down animals that are bigger than themselves, say, which some would use as a definition for carnivorous style hunting versus omnivorous style hunting. But chimpanzees actually have, in one way of looking at it, they have a fat-based metabolism because their diet, you know, it might be, if you think about it just superficially, you might think that they have a high carb diet, but what they actually have is a high fiber diet. They're folivores, they eat leaves, and even the fruit that they eat in the wild is mostly fibrous, full of pith. And fiber is not digestible by any vertebrates. The only way that we get away with getting nutrition from it, and all the herbivores do this, is by having a huge colony of bacteria in the gut. Bacteria can break down fiber, and the product of that, when they have broken it down, is that they give off fatty acids, short chain fatty acids. And so the primary basis of the metabolism of an herbivore, including chimpanzees, is fat. It's just that it's fat secondary to fiber. What happened on the line that led to humans is we started progressively trading off brain size for intestinal tissue size. Both of those organs take up a lot of energy. It takes a huge amount of energy to run intestinal tissue, and it takes a huge amount of energy to run brain tissue. And what we were able to do is trade one for the other, but the only way that you can make that trade is if you're not relying on as much contribution from fiber to get fat as you were before. So as our intestines started shrinking, we gave up a whole lot of real estate where bacteria were. And the only way that that would have been possible at the time that that was occurring was to get it from fat. We couldn't get it from carbohydrates because there weren't enough available year-round consistently that we would have had access to. And before the advent, the widespread use of fire in cooking, fire use goes back quite a bit farther than widespread regular use of fire for cooking does. Those are often conflated. Without the fire to break down, say, a source where you'd have a tuber, it's actually mostly fiber. So, and we certainly didn't have grain agriculture yet. So I'm not saying that we didn't get any contribution from carbohydrates, but it wouldn't have been enough to support a child that's growing year-round who needs that energy for their brain to grow day after day, week after week, year upon year. And we couldn't use protein to the extent that, say, other carnivores use them because humans, coming from that primate line, have constraints on the ability to get energy from protein. I'm not sure the exact amount for a given person, but I think I've seen 3.3 grams per kilogram. Once you start eating too much protein, the byproducts of metabolism start to actually be detrimental to the body, and there have been shown the ceiling of how much energy we can get from protein that's much lower than the amount of protein that a cat or a dog could get from their diet. And so that really only leaves fat. And that would be all theoretical if it weren't for the fact that we also have evidence, archaeological evidence, that humans started prioritizing, I mean, and again, not just humans, but Homo, and even before them, Australopithecus on the Homo line, started prioritizing fat by branching out first into scavenging. And when we're scavenging from what the carnivores left over, the carnivores are going to eat the organs and all of the high protein meat, and what they're mostly going to leave is bones. So the skull, which has the very fatty brain inside it and very nutritious brain, and the marrow. So we started from there, and then I believe this bootstrapped us onto the hunting of large game that we have evidence for. We probably are the reason that the megafauna the large animals that used to roam the earth went into extinction massively worldwide. Definitely, whether we were the cause or not, that happened. And that's important because a lot of people will look at wild animals that are available for hunting today and they would say, oh, look, if humans were relying on hunting, they were getting this very, very lean meat. But it's simply not the case that through most of our history, those animals were the only, those animals are basically the ones that we didn't hunt to extinction because they weren't fat enough. Is one way of looking at it. Fat has been of utmost importance for humans as we evolved. And I think that when the megafauna started disappearing, we were actually at quite a crisis point where it became necessary for our survival as a species to start turning to the high carb agriculture that we have today saved us and can be used by us given the right tools, the right farming, fire. But that doesn't mean that we aren't supremely evolved to use animal fat to meet those needs as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, you're talking about the sustenance required to grow a child, but not just grow a child, grow that individual to maturity, and then next generation progressively see brain size increase. And we actually see from the start of settled farming 10 to 15,000 years ago that, depending on how you define it, you know, there's a great couple of books on all that. Against the Grain's brilliant, and Guns, Germs and Steel touches a lot on that. And that our brains have shrunk. And that's a really short space of time for something like that to happen. So it's remarkable, really, that if you think, okay, in that time we've had all this abundance of grain, then if the theory was that it was eating carbohydrates that helped us grow our brain, then it doesn't chime very well with that observation. And I guess... a question that comes up quite a lot in keto and low carb is what sort of fat should I eat? And when I was talking to Peter from Hyperlipid about this, you know, he was quite open about what he eats. He generally just has lamb mince, which is easy to find in the UK, but it's more expensive than beef mince. It's probably about twice as expensive, but so good and always fatty. And he would add, you know, some beef dripping to the pan. And I tend to eat very similarly. Is that enough? You know, you talk about carnivores in the wild killing game and taking the organs that were available other than the brain and the bone marrow. So if you're just eating kind of rendered beef dripping and muscle meat, is that enough?
That's a great question. And I'm going to hedge a bit in my answer because, well, we don't have enough information, but one thing we do know on the organ side is that organs definitely concentrate a lot of nutrients that we know are important. And so if anyone's on a carnivore diet and is feeling worried about their need for nutritional elements, organs are always available for that. Seafood also can be a really great source of many of the same nutrients. But on the other side of it, we also have a collection of, I want to call them OG carnivores, who have been eating a carnivorous diet for as long as I have or even longer, and many of them don't eat organs or eat them rarely or just simply eat them at a lower rate than you would want to if you were trying to match RDAs exactly. And not only do they not seem to be having any issues related to deficiencies, but in some cases adding organs have Well, these are anecdotal reports, but in some cases, trying to add more in the form of liver has actually caused them to feel less well. And so you could speculate that there is something about the elimination of carbohydrates or the elimination of plant anti-nutrients that may be making some of those, either a combination of allowing you to use some of those nutrients more efficiently, or getting less interference. On the other hand, I know of people who have some kind of illness ongoing where they have definitely seen things like folate deficiency develop that probably has some kind of connection to something that they're battling, whereas a person who's resolved all their health issues and is just kind of riding along on a carnivore diet might not need that extra supplementation.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess observations of tribes that are kind of modern hunter-gatherers notice that they have a very good relationship with the environment in terms of understanding what's safe to eat and what's medicinal to eat. And there's that great story of the man who was lost in the United States somewhere in the 19th century, I think, and was helped by a Native American. The man had gone blind, and the Native American knew to feed him fish eyes because of the retinol in there.
Wow!
And the man recovered his sight.
That's amazing.
So there's this, I think there's this understanding that we've lost. You know, one of the remarkable things about technology is it can be lost in the blink of an eye, can't it? 10 years, 20 years, and it's gone. And I think that's true in our culture for sure.
Retinol is a really interesting one because there are problems that can develop from not getting enough, but there are also problems that can develop from getting too much. And the liver holds on to so much vitamin A, that's why liver is a good source of it, that it can be really difficult to pinpoint when you're getting too much, because if you're getting too much and it's not so much too much that it's causing immediate symptoms, but say just more than you need, your liver will be a buffer for toxicity because it stores more and more and more and more. And it won't actually give you any symptoms of too much retinol until that buffer has started to overflow. So I think that's caused a lot of confusion about the safety of vitamin A and of overeating something like liver. I think that in our society, there may be actually more of a problem of chronic excess vitamin A than inadequate vitamin A, which would be more the case in developing countries where access to animal food is inadequate and they're really suffering from not enough retinol. Some people have even gone so far as to suggest that that some of the benefit of carnivore has been, and in the style of carnivore where you're not eating a lot of organs, is to allow a normalization of retinol, which had been too much, in part because a lot of foods in the standard American diet have been fortified with retinol, such that I've even seen a study where they had access to people who had just died and checked their livers for retinol status. And I think a third of them were deficient and a third of them were excessive hypervitaminosis A, which is really quite astonishing to me.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's so interesting how these local minima, you might call them, or local maxima, appear when you think you're doing the right thing by, I guess, using what they call surrogate endpoints. You know, if I eat 5 fruit and veg a day, then I will be healthy. If I have heart-healthy whole grain Cheerios twice a day, I'll be even healthier. I mean, it's true also on the other end of the spectrum, isn't it? It's kind of common in the biohacking community to measure levels of various markers. You know, something you talk about in the book about, you know, maybe is measuring things like cortisol, homocysteine, thyroid hormone and stuff worth the pursuit?
Yeah, it's confusing because the ranges where things are defined as normal, some of it comes from physiological understanding of what the human body needs, but some of it comes from just measuring a lot of people and seeing where they are. And if the population is not as healthy as it could be, then you could argue that having a measurement that is beyond on one end or the other could actually be an improvement. And then it becomes even more confusing when you're comparing a low carb diet to a high carb diet, because there are so many metabolic changes that are associated. I mean, to take a very extreme example, or one that's very understandable, if you measure the blood of someone who's on a high carb diet and you find that they have high levels of ketones in the blood, that's an emergency. That's a huge problem. Like, something's going wrong. But if you measure the same level of ketones in the blood of someone on a low carb diet, it's not a problem at all. In fact, it's quite normal. So the pursuit of some of these targets can be wrong on that level, and it can also be wrong on the level of a dissociation between what those measures were a proxy for in the first place. So it could be that you've developed a whole bunch of risk factors for some disease endpoint, and then you start, instead of trying to pursue the endpoint itself, you start trying to pursue these particular numbers, and there's a law, Goodhart's law, which basically says that the more you target a specific measure as a proxy for a goal, the less that goal, that proxy associates with the goal, because now you've actually broken the association by pursuing one instead of the other.
Yes, it is interesting. There's obviously some benefit in tracking and feedback and self-improvement through that route, but there's limits, I think. Okay, dragging it right back to thing about plants again, because I think if people are following and they're like, wow, that's really interesting, maybe I've never even heard of carnivore, and you know, this is a great kind of ride, but there's always something in the back of their mind about fiber and vitamin C. They're the two big boys, aren't they, really? You know, what's your stock answer for people who throw fiber and vitamin C back at you?
Well, fiber is a funny one. Like we were talking about earlier, we actually can't get any nutrition directly from it. We can feed our bacteria and then get those short chain fatty acids, and a lot of people talk about how our colon cells benefit from those short chain fatty acids, and they often do, but plant fiber isn't the only way to generate those, because you're going to have bacteria in your gut regardless. It turns out, regardless of whether you feed them plant fiber or not, you're going to have a huge gut population, and many of them are still going to be generating short chain fatty acids, sometimes even from what's called animal fiber, so collagens and chondroitin and things that don't digest as well in the upper tract. You could point to animal studies, or even just look at carnivores in the wild. I've emphasized that we're different from those carnivores in many ways, but if you just think about intestinal tissue, I don't think that our intestines are so drastically different from carnivore intestines that the tissue itself would have different requirements. And if a cat can have a healthy colon without adding plant fiber, then it stands to reason that that shouldn't be the difference between a healthy colon and an unhealthy one. Other arguments that people have made about fiber in the past come back to things that just don't apply to a low-carb diet. For example, if you replace refined carbohydrates with carbohydrates that come from more fiber, you can get things like better blood sugar control. But obviously that doesn't apply to someone who's not eating any refined carbohydrates in the first place. And in fact, if we're talking about refined carbohydrates, it seems that if you look at epidemiological associations that might say, oh, people with more fiber in their diet are healthier, epidemiology is always fraught. But one thing that I think the fiber signal is in epidemiological studies is just a marker of the absence of refined carbohydrates. People who are eating more fiber in general are eating, it's a replacement of refined carbohydrates. And if you see it that way, if insofar as that is the reason behind that association, there are probably others that don't have to do with the nutritional components of fiber as well, then obviously it becomes completely inapplicable to a meat-only diet that doesn't include, or even a paleo diet that doesn't include a lot of refined grains, for example. As to vitamin C, that's a fascinating one that I did a real deep dive into for a few years a while back, because What was interesting to me was that vitamin C is one of the very few nutrients that is more available in plant foods than animal foods.
I think that surprises people, doesn't it? That that plants aren't replete with nutrition in a way that meat is just cardboard with a lovely flavor.
Yeah, I mean, people really do think of meat as protein, just protein. Like, you look at a plate that's got your deck of cards size block of meat on it and everything else, plants, and what most people see when they see that is protein that coming from the meat and everything else that you need coming from the plants. And it's really, really a divergence from the truth. There's so much bioavailable nutrition in meat, and even just muscle meat, and if you're going to include other things like seafood and organs, then it just skyrockets. And the sometimes the forms are equivalent, but sometimes they're not, in such a way that the form of the vitamin that you're getting from meat is superior to the form that you're getting from plants. It's never the other way around. And then there's this whole contribution from plants, since plants have this unfortunate problem that they can't run away. Their defense against predation is primarily biochemical. And so plants are just full of all these anti-nutrients, which are attempts to make the nutrients that they do come with less available. So, for example, a well-known example is the phytates in grains and legumes are very detrimental to the ability to absorb minerals like zinc. So there are certain cases where the more plants you put on your plate, the less nutritious it is. But vitamin C is kind of an exception to that, because many plants are high sources of vitamin C. Vitamin C is related chemically to glucose, and in plants it's made out of glucose, and there's this process through the ripening of fruit, for example, where glucose is turning, or where where vitamin C and glucose are developing, and meat doesn't have that. There's a misconception that meat has no vitamin C. That's absolutely not true. In fact, there's enough vitamin C in just plain old muscle meat, as long as you don't cook it to really well done, to cover your needs such that you wouldn't get scurvy if you're eating carnivore level that is. So if you're eating 1 to 2 pounds a day, you're going to get your anti-scorbutic dose, but just barely. And so it was surprising to me that all of these people that I knew through Fora and such who were eating carnivore diets were not developing scurvy. There were a couple of exceptions in the early days, and the common factor in those people who did develop scurvy is that they were eating pemmican only, which is a very a dried and then heat applied form of meat, because there's heat that comes in the grinding, so you can lose all the vitamin C that way. And then the other observation was that even in the early Arctic explorer days, we were finding, or they were finding, that meat cured scurvy. So how can that possibly be? It not only is meat is a low source of vitamin C, so you could imagine that it would be enough maybe to barely stave it off, but you would expect to see a lot of edge cases. And one of the ideas that I found that I think might be the explanation for that has to do with carnitine. So vitamin C is a vitamin because we need it in order to synthesize collagen and carnitine. There are other things that it does. It's an antioxidant, for example, but those are really critical things, because if we don't have the ability to make collagen, then we can't repair wounds. And if we don't have the ability to make carnitine, we can't get energy, because even if you're on a high carb diet, you're still getting plenty of energy from fat. And to get energy from fat, you have to transport it into the mitochondria, and that takes carnitine. So one of the first symptom of scurvy is fatigue. And I think that that's because of lack of carnitine. So carnitine is abundant in meat, red meat especially. And it seems to me that if you're eating meat, you're getting some vitamin C, but you're also getting this factor that greatly alleviates the need to use vitamin C for a vital function that's happening constantly every day, all the time. And so my observation that many people in the carnivore community, most people, are not suffering from any signs of vitamin C deficiency, the explanation that I would give for that is that carnitine and some vitamin C for meat is enough to allay that kind of problem.
Yeah, it's a very interesting part of it all. I think the worry about vitamin C and the worry about cholesterol are the two that seem to come up the most when it comes to carnivore and keto, respectively. It's been really great talking to you. I think we've covered a lot of stuff that we didn't get to in the last one, and it's always nice to talk about these things from a fundamental level. And you know, with someone who's obviously thought through them so well. What's next, and where can people find you?
Well, I'm continuing to work on the book. The next chapter will be about, it will follow closely a presentation I gave last year called The Lipivore, which covers many of the things we talked about today about the special role of fat in the human diet and what makes us as a species particularly having an affinity for fat and fat metabolism. I'm also working on a paper that will cover the effects of ketogenic diets on sleep. So this is something I've never written or talked about before, and I'm very excited about that. And I can be found far too often on Twitter. My handle there is Keto Carnivore, and I am very responsive to questions, so I'm happy to talk to anybody about any of this on that forum.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again, Amber.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and see you next time.